Hello, everyone. Today we are joined by the mighty Aaron Good, a surname well deserved. He is the author of the unmissable book American Exception and host of the podcast of the same name. Like, share, subscribe. He is an expert at tracking the connections, the individuals, the elements, the agencies that been behind the right and the irresistible rise of America to superpower status and the kind of key events in that process. One event that looms particularly large, of course, and Aaron has done some superb, really groundbreaking work on, is the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Recently I noticed, well, he's also been doing some tremendous digging into James Angleton, the CIA's notorious counterintelligence chief, who not only created Mossad but created his own personal spying network outside of agency structures while running the Israeli account for the CIA and doing so without any oversight whatsoever, and simultaneously potentially running Lee Harvey Oswald, JFK's alleged killer, as an asset. Yes, what a murky web we weave when we practice to deceive. Aaron, might you like to talk our viewers and listeners through your latest work on how ultra-Zionist neoconservatism took over the American deep state?
Yes, and thank you for the introduction and the platform here to talk about this. I recently spoke at a 9/11 conference and presented some of this material. They gave me 50 minutes. I probably needed about 3 hours, but I've been kicking this around in my head for so long. I plan to write a book about it eventually. And it comes from the start of this, trying to look at this issue particularly. Of course, October 7 really ramps this up. But even before that, I had done a series of many episodes worth of interviews with Peter Dale Scott on his life story. It's an oral history of sorts, because his life is really fascinating, and he lived through the study of all these deep events. He knew the earliest JFK researchers. You know, he spoke at an event with like Mae Brussel and Mark Lane. Dick Gregory back in the day. I mean, he had dinner at Huey Newton's apartment once. He was at Altamont. He was best friends with Dan Ellsberg. He just had this life that's unbelievable. And he has written pretty much everybody that looks into the sort of conspiratorial aspects of U.S. history knows of Peter and references his work a lot. But what I found when I spoke to him more was, and probed him about different questions, was that he was extremely circumspect about the role of Israel, even though there came to be reason for me to believe that he would have to understand that there would be an Israeli hand in some of these episodes, because it seems to be the only explanation for certain things. And the more that I asked him about this, the more he seemed to agree with me, and yet was very quiet about it. And so I eventually found that he had been given murder threats. I mean, he had what he thought were the only real credible murder threats he'd ever gotten pertains to the question of Israel, which now, of course, if we're looking at how their solution to every, you know, problem that vexes them is to kill the person who's the source of the problem. I mean, it seems kind of like it seems clear that this is the way that they operate. And with the genocide, of course, this just super confirms it, and the pager attacks and so on. There's just so much that points to them being even worse than what most of their critics thought. We were talking about, you mentioned the JFK assassination, and it is actually the best window to look at this state, this system that arose in the U.S., this what we could call the deep state, which is not merely the intelligence agencies or the bureaucracy. That's the way that the media wants to characterize it, or liberals want to. They want to say, oh, these people who are talking about the deep state, they're talking about the administrative state, but you really need an administrative state to have a functional government and so on, right? But that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about the ways in which you have a top-down government, top-down governance, top-down regime in a nominal democracy. It's supposed to be a lawful democracy, but we have endemic law-breaking, institutionalized law-breaking, both in foreign policy and in the arrangements of organized crime, having so much sway over realms of the economy and geographic areas as well. So there's something, you need a framework to explain that. And Peter's work was very useful for that. I came up with my own theory to explain the state and this regime, which was the tripartite state theory, which says, yes, there's a public state with democracy and all that and elections and so on. And then there's a security state, which is all the officials in the security bureaucracies. And then there's a deep state, which is intertwined with the public state. It involves public officials, sometimes bribed public officials, sometimes blackmailed public officials like Dennis Hastert, longest serving Republican Secretary of State, who was a pedophile and who was being blackmailed probably through his whole career. It probably explains his whole career. Okay. And the drug, the fix between the drug traffickers and law enforcement, this would be another aspect of it. And really what the key to understanding this is that it's oligarchy. It's the way that oligarchy is the real system, the functional system, when it pretends to be a democracy. So it's not really ruled by the demos or the people. It's ruled by powerful, wealthy men, generally men. We could say families, sometimes women, but generally women. It's generally men. It's a patriarchal affair. But what this means is that it's not the system exactly as, well, the state is the executive arm of the bourgeoisie, or it's the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. It's not quite that simple. There is some pluralism, but not in the way that we think there is, not in the way that, oh, you have to think about about labor and women's groups and all these different groups in democracy, and somehow they all balance each other out in a particular way, and then you get democracy. Okay, that's the generic Western liberal view of how it works. But that's not really what happens. You do have pluralism at the top in that you can have factions of oligarchs who would be pitted against each other over control of, especially over control of the state. And that's really the definition of a regime, is those, that set of institutions that control who has access to control the state, who controls the state. So that's, people want some political science, or you always hear people say the word regime. This is what regime really means in political science. It's all those institutions that determine who has control of the state. And we have a different kind of regime than we're led to believe. For example, most strikingly in the JFK assassination, because he was the head of state and he was removed by, we could say, the regime, to be most accurate, because it's these parts of this, of our system of governance that are kind of hidden from us, but they do determine who can and cannot be president. And they, by eliminating JFK, you see that there is a power that overrides democracy, and then to have the ability to cover up for decades. I mean, the evidence of a cover up is so extensive with all the medical evidence and everything. I'm not even going to try to go through any of that here. Really, if you're not a student of the assassination, then you could study these things. The original Oliver Stone JFK movie actually lays out a lot of the basic forensic problems and the absurdities behind Oswald as the lone shooter who gets killed by another lone shooter. It's ridiculous. Now, the real key, if you're studying it, to get further into, you know, it's pretty easy to say, oh, yeah, or to see people connected to the CIA were involved in the assassination because they have these ties to some of the figures. But Jack Ruby may be the most important character. Jack Ruby was depicted in the mob as kind of a, or sorry, depicted in the press at the time as a sort of sleazy character, but somebody who did this on behalf of the president probably. And he said that he did it. The first thing he said was that he did it to keep Jackie from suffering, but that was not very believable. And he's a hoodlum of sorts. There's a person named Lewis Kuttner who was a famous attorney who did other things politically and also had government connections. I believe he was involved in the death of Fred Hampton later. But in 1963, he came out after Ruby was arrested, after Ruby shot Oswald on, you know, national television. He said Jack Ruby is a lieutenant in the syndicate, you know, the crime syndicate that people had been talking about, like Robert Kennedy especially was speaking about this. Other people talked about the mafia or La Cosa Nostra, you know, Hoover and the Federal Bureau of Narcotics made up this, or they had this idea of an Italian mafia. But Robert Kennedy said, no, you got to look at the Vegas casinos and their role in money laundering, and you need to look at the Teamsters and their role in this nationwide corruption network. Okay, so they're talking about something different. Louis Kuttner, after Ruby was arrested, said that Ruby was a syndicate lieutenant and that he had worked with him, I guess been his legal counsel or something to that effect, during the Kefauver Committee in 1950, and that he had testified to the Kefauver Committee, which was the first big investigation of organized crime in the U.S. Ruby gave them testimony, you know, behind closed doors, about the Chicago outfit. But the deal was that they would give Dallas a clean bill of health. Okay, so this gets ignored totally, that he said this by the press, or by the Warren Commission at least. It was written up in the press, but not written much more about after the fact. And the Warren Commission just ignored it and that totally obscured his links to organized crime, which is that's all he was. He was an organized crime guy. He was very close to the Vegas mob and the people associated with the Vegas mob in L.A. He worked at Johnny Rosselli's racetrack, for example. Johnny Rosselli's in the mobster that the CIA was working with to assassinate Castro. So, I mean, that's very interesting. Also, Sirhan worked at the Santa Anita racetrack. Also, the same Johnny Rosselli's racetrack.
Wasn't that where he was injured? He was injured and then may well have been treated by MKUltra doctors.
Yes, I believe it was another racetrack. And he wasn't employed by the Santa Anita racetrack, but with people in the Southern California horse racing milieu. And he worked at Santa Anita. I think it was at a different racetrack where he fell off the horse. But the point is, this was a very corrupted, mobbed up area. And it was the Santa Anita racetrack, which is kind of the hub of it, is owned by this mobster figure who is involved in CIA assassinations. And he does disappear for a time after that. And when he comes back, his family says he starts acting very differently. She's a changed person after this head injury, which that happens sometimes after a head injury. But there aren't records about where exactly he was. And he was gone for a longer amount of time than it would make any sense just from having a concussion from falling off a horse. So a lot of people believe he was an MKUltra subject, essentially. But getting back to Ruby... when they arrest him, well, the first thing they do when JFK is shot, there's this warning to people, especially Earl Warren, that look, if you investigate this and it's a conspiracy, this Oswald guy, he's been to Mexico City talking to the KGB. And if we actually uncover a conspiracy, it'll lead to the Soviet Union, nuclear war, and millions of people will die. So you've already got a way to say, hey, this needs to not be a conspiracy, Justice Earl Warren. And if you find a conspiracy, then you might end up, you know, bringing about the end of the world. This is one way they blackmail him. But the other way that they effectively blackmail the U.S. establishment, the plotters of the assassination, is by having Jack Ruby in jail, because he is connected to the National Crime Syndicate in such a way that to expose him would be a disaster for the American establishment, for America's place in the world, because he connects to the National Crime Syndicate. Back in 1939, Jack Ruby was in the room when Leon Cook was murdered. Leon Cook was a Chicago Junk Handler Union president, and Ruby was the number two there. And that killing was written about by Robert F. Kennedy in his book, The Enemy Within, about the National Crime Syndicate that was emerging. He wrote about this as the pivotal moment in which the mob took over Teamster pension funds. which is an important part of their whole operation. The Teamsters, especially Teamster loans to Vegas, helped to build up the Strip when it was harder for them to get as many loans initially because they had such a bad reputation with all these mobsters and so on there. But the Teamsters just gave them enormous amounts of money to build up these casinos. And Las Vegas itself, it was established in around 1946. And in 1945, Meyer Lansky's the head of the crime syndicate, essentially. He and Lucky Luciano, but Luciano was in jail until Lansky gets him out with the help of the government because Lansky's working with the government. So the people probably know this, a lot of your listeners, but in 1941, the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA, along with Naval Intelligence, worked with mobsters to supposedly keep the docks secure so that they wouldn't be infiltrated by fascists. And they approach Meyer Lansky, and Lansky says, well, yeah, I can help you, but you need to get my assistant or my colleague, Mr. Lucky Luciano, out of prison. So they do. And they're helpful to the U.S., I think, with the invasion of Sicily and also supposedly keeping the docks free of sabotage. But that is a question as to how much of that was legitimate in any way, what's really going on there. So Lansky, in 1945, for his service, is given the Medal of Freedom by President Harry Truman, who I believe is epitomizes the corruption of the Democratic Party. He comes from Missouri. And Kansas City, the Pendergast political machine, which was a very mobbed up enterprise. And the whole Democratic Party, I believe, is very much tied to Teamster corruption and the mob, basically. It's like the Republicans, oligarchs are basically big business, Standard Oil and so on, by and large. And the Democrats, probably their most moneyed backers are, I mean, of course, they're still friendly with some Wall Street types, but also the syndicate. They're closer tied to the syndicate than because they're more the party of the people, party of labor unions. But the labor unions are dominated, importantly, by the mob, especially the Teamsters, most notoriously. So this aspect of American politics is more dark than people want to realize. The parties are more connected to the mob. There's a guy who approaches a Dallas sheriff. I think it's Paul Roland Jones, I believe. And he approaches the Dallas sheriff in like the late 50s or early 60s. And he says, we're going to try to take this town over. And if you back us on this, we're going to use the Teamsters to do it. And if you can back us on this, we'll get you Harry Truman to write a letter recommending your reelection. Right. So this is how do they have this kind of juice? Now, in 1945, Lansky's given the Medal of Honor for Harry Truman for his great service to freedom and all that. It's also the same year that he sets up a drug connection with this associate of his, Harold Meltzer, in Mexico City. And it's to deal with the disruption of overseas routes, drug routes, because of World War II. They set up this heroin connection in Mexico. And if you're going to do that, you need a place to launder the money that's like strategically placed. So Las Vegas is, you know, in the American Southwest, and it's close to L.A. And so Lansky just picks up this little desert town, which is like a filling station or something like this at this point. And he decides that's going to be his mecca in the desert. And that's what Las Vegas is set up to do. It's set up to launder drug money coming from this Mexican drug connection. They always depict Lansky as like this guy who was involved in gambling. I mean, if you read about what they write about him today, he was really involved in gambling. And he believed that in this and that about gambling. But the real money is the drugs. And the gambling, the casinos, probably more useful for laundering money than anything else. And in fact, this is something that you would need some forensic accounting and, teams of people working forever on this. I would wonder if Las Vegas was really viable, but for the sheer amount of drug money that they had at their disposal. But you build up these fabulous casinos with these Teamster loans, and you create this place where enough people come and it becomes this thing, and there's all these showgirls around, and it's, it's this exciting place to do whatever. You create a kind of illusion. Hold on, I'm going to close my window here. Sorry, there's police sirens out there.
We just cut that out anyway. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Las Vegas is like this illusion created in the desert with mob money and with drug to deal with drug money coming in and to launder money from this new heroin connection that became a big, and it became a big part of the U.S. drug traffic. And the syndicate had a monopoly essentially on drug traffic in the United States. And at one point, Lansky says, we're bigger than U.S. Steel, which was the biggest corporation in the U.S. And that may have been true. And another way that they corrupted much of the of politics in the U.S. was through the National Wire Service. And this was a service that was, I think it was mostly done by telephone or telegraph, mostly telephone. And it gave people the racing results for the day. And it was it worked best as a monopoly. At times it was fought over a little bit, but there's this turf war over who's going to control it. The original one was controlled, I believe, by Mo Annenberg, but he went to jail because he was an associate of Lansky. There's another prominent Zionist as well, by the way. That family ends up like owning TV Guide, the Philly Inquirer. I mean, very rich, powerful people. But the son is a different Annenberg, and that's the person who ends up taking over the wire service. But first, they have to kill this guy, James Reagan, who was trying to run it. And they use these guys like Sam Yaris and Lenny Patrick, who are also very close to Jack Ruby, people he'd known for many years. So Jack Ruby's really there and tied to two of the most pivotal events in the establishment of the National Crime Syndicate. He's in the room when Leon Cook gets murdered and the pension funds go to the Teamsters, or go to the mob, the Teamster pension funds do. And then close friends of his killed James Reagan. And that was written up by Drew Pearson before he got killed, I believe, or after. But there was something written about it beforehand. Drew Pearson was the most famous syndicated columnist in the U.S. About politics, if not the most famous up there. And he wrote about how his friend, James Reagan, was being threatened by mobsters. And it was over the wire service. And that Pearson himself went to talk to J. Edgar Hoover, because that's how much juice Pearson had. And Hoover said, well, this involves people like Henry Crown and the Hilton Hotel chain. And I think the Annenberg is mentioned as well, perhaps. But anyway, it involves people that are prominent. He said people who used to have some issues, but now they cleaned up their act. Well, these are very important people. I mean, I'm not going to try to go into Henry Crown and Lester Crown, but people can do more web searching on them. Lester Crown, decades later, gave Obama a thumbs up and saying he's okay, he's one of us, like to make Jewish voters feel okay with Obama back, you know, many years later. So this is the kind of power we're talking about. But the point is that Jack Ruby was not this low-level hoodlum. He was a person connected to the National Crime Syndicate. And that's really more of a Lansky Las Vegas Teamsters thing than this Italian mafia. The Italian mafia is what the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and the FBI come up with to try to explain that there's this National Crime Syndicate. And so they have this Italian cover story, basically. But it really doesn't quite work that way. It's quite a simplification. It's really a Lansky Teamster mafia syndicate, would be a more accurate way to say it. And Ruby he's in jail. And if they were to investigate what Ruby really was, it would, the justification at the time to cover it up would be, well, this would lead to the crime syndicate. And the fact that we have people in high places who are totally compromised by mobsters. I mean, Lansky himself worked with the government as an informant back in, I think, 19, in the 30s to help them arrest. He essentially was a stool pigeon. He helped them arrest Louis Buckhalter, who was the top drug trafficker and the guy who ran Murder Incorporated at the time. And so since then, he seemed to have protection from the head of the Bureau of Narcotics and the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, FBI, and then Harry Anslinger. So Lansky is protected at the very top. He has this much juice, the Lansky Syndicate does, which is remarkable. So with Ruby in jail, you have this person who is extremely suspicious, and he points to political arrangements that journalists can't really understand and social scientists don't want to even try to reckon with. And it just points to, if you're objective, a fascistic kind of formation that's hidden but omnipresent throughout this supposedly democratic society. And when you, it, maybe Earl Warren thought Jack Ruby was very suspicious, but he figured that, well, since Lee Oswald could lead the nuclear war, somebody probably hired the mob just to knock off Oswald. So now we've got to clean up the mess. That may have been, it may have been as simple as that, what his thinking was. Alternatively, he could have thought, well, if this was somehow by American actors and they have the power to kill the president and put me in this position, you know, I have to go along here either way. So he's got every reason to go along with this big cover up. And that's what we get. But the real, I mean, the significance of it is it's a total reversal of U.S. policy when Kennedy is killed. He sends his brother to the Soviet, or he sends his brother, his brother and Jackie Kennedy send an emissary to the USSR a week after JFK is killed, a guy named William Walton. And he tells the Soviets, he's there on like a kind of artistic exchange, but really he has a message. And he says, we know that you didn't kill Jack Kennedy. He was killed by domestic opponents. It was a right-wing conspiracy. By the policy of peace that JFK was pursuing is going to be not going to be pursued by Johnson. He's too close to big business. But Bobby plans to make a run for the Senate and then the White House eventually. And when he does, the quest for peace can resume. And that was a message that they sent to them. So whatever people want to say about the Kennedys and the Kennedys' politics were, you know, liberal reformists, but a kind of liberal reformist that we don't even really see today at all. And that, I think, is notable. I mean, he, if you go and look at many of the statements that he made about all sorts of subjects like, you know, poverty in America and foreign policy. Yes, he made many, you know, Cold War statements that I think were pretty much pro forma for back then. And there's all sorts of things you can talk about in terms of his making hawkish Cold Warrior policies. But I think that was a prerequisite for even participating in the insane Cold War politics of the day. The policies that he was pursuing and the reforms he was seeking, things like detente with the Soviet Union, getting rid of nuclear weapons, pursuing world peace explicitly, seeking normalization potentially with Cuba. These were things that were completely reversed. A pullout from Vietnam, I mean, that was the policy at the time that Kennedy was killed, was a pullout to be completed in 1965. You can say JFK would have reversed it if he'd lived. That's true. But the policy when he died was a policy of withdrawal, a phased withdrawal from Vietnam to be completed by 1965. And all of that changes. And the policy towards Israel does the most dramatic 180 of all, because JFK was saying, if you continue to not let us inspect your nuclear sites, we will consider cutting off aid. We'll change this relationship. And that additionally, he sought to find a way to solve the Palestinian problem as well. And Kennedy was friendlier to Arabs, friendlier to Nasser, especially more so than any president before or after. So Johnson comes in, it's a total 180. You get the Six-Day War, that they get the nuclear bomb, and so on and so forth. Johnson is very corrupt. He's tied to this scandal. In fact, he's potentially going to get kicked off the ticket when Kennedy gets killed, because he's involved in a scandal with Bobby Baker and Henry Crown and General Dynamics, weapons maker, over a fighter plane that was it was very corrupt procurement process and so on. And then Johnson gets rescued by the assassination. So this points to a level of corruption and lawlessness in the state that Western political science can't really handle. And a lot of doctrinaire Marxists just think, it's just the bourgeois state. It's just the dictatorship of capital and so on, which functionally it can work as a top-down, you know, manifestation of the will of the wealthy. That's pretty clear in the abstract sense. However, when you see them killing people like this, or when you see things like Watergate happening, or when you see things like Epstein, you have to think that, well, they actively manage this system. It doesn't just operate because everybody is following the interests of capital sort of robotically, and therefore this is the outcome that we get. you have to like sexually blackmail a lot of people. You have to do really devious, terrible things like, oh, we found a pedophile wrestling coach. We'll make him the Speaker of the House because then we'll totally control him. I mean, this, so it involves a lot of skullduggery, and that's coming to the surface, especially in recent years. And now I think people are more ready to accept things that they wouldn't have accepted earlier.
Well, just to go back to the Israel question for a moment, Aaron, there was writings done a number of years ago now by a British author, Misha Glenny, in a book called Mafia, which identified Israel as one of the key sites for arms trafficking, people trafficking, and sex trafficking, and drug trafficking, centered around both Israelis who'd come from the former Soviet Union and also those who had a direct connection with the United States. Now, given what you've just outlined about in your analysis of like the American state and its sort of tripartite nature and its clandestine relationship with the National Crime Syndicate and figures like Meir Lansky, and this sort of very criminal nature of the Israeli regime that still exists to this day, does this help to explain, Aaron, like the usage, the utility that Israel has for various elements in the United States, and also the power of Israel within the United States?
Yes, in ways that we'll never be able to perfectly quantify, but yes, there are aspects of the JFK assassination that tie into other events. I just want to mention that besides Lansky's ties to Israel, you know, he was involved in 1948, he was one of the main pivotal people in terms of the arms smuggling to the Zionists. Also involved with that was Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters. So there's the syndicate right there with Israel at the beginning. And in fact, without Hoffa and Lansky, who knows if that would have even been possible, except that's so they were a huge help there. And additionally, they, you know, the money laundering is this, the drug trade is just this enormous trade internationally. It's one of the top three commodities traded worldwide. And so this ends up being a huge source of money for black budget funds and so on. And additionally, the syndicate gives the people who run military intelligence and so on, it gives them access to the hired killers and deniability. So the one key figure in the CIA is James Angleton, and he managed to be in charge of the Mossad account. And this was kept totally secret. And this is a way that the U.S. could outsource some assassinations to people, to different entities, and have their, you know, their hands clean, supposedly. And this goes up to the present day, because in 2020, there's a Gray Zone article about how when they wanted to kill Assange and surveil Assange, but they eventually plot his assassination, they outsourced this to the Sands Casino Security Division, essentially, which is run by Sheldon Adelson. So it's really like this Murder Incorporated relationship still exists. And the interesting thing is, when I pointed this out, you know, Adelson's money comes from the Sands Casino, which is literally a Lansky joint. It was literally a Lansky joint that's now run by the Adelson family. And when the CIA, Mike Pompeo, wanted Assange surveilled and potentially killed, that's who he went to. It's the same. I mean, it's kind of staggering they would still do that. Now, when I brought this up, when I mentioned this during my presentation to the 9/11 conference, the audio and video went out. Like, it didn't come back on until I moved on. It was very strange. And it actually is an extremely relevant point. And that was the day that Charlie Kirk died, too, if you want to make it even weirder. It was later that day. So go figure. But this role is important. And I don't think that it's just that the U.S. turns to them and says, hey, we can't really do this. Do you know anybody who might kill people? Israel? I think that the Zionists have fought for this role and that they have used it. And that the more that they have been used over the years in these ways, the more blackmail power they have on the U.S. I mean, an enormous amount. I think that this high political blackmail is a huge part of it. they were likely involved in the JFK assassination. And Peter didn't believe this, but would not talk about it. He wrote about it more in two books, but both of those books were suppressed back in the 70s and then one like 1980. And we found manuscripts of this. And in the margins, Peter wrote, there's one where he writes, if Mossad, if Israel had this kind of pivotal operational role in the assassination of JFK, they would not have done that without the without approval from a higher authority in the U.S. because it would have been suicidal for them as a state at that point. So they are, they're intertwined in this. The U.S. has used them in some ways. I think with the JFK assassination, they were limited by the fact that JFK had control of the state. And so he was a powerful person with some security around him.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that one of the most interesting excerpts from the newly declassified files that were released under Trump's executive order earlier this year. There's one file which shows that on November 18, 1963, which is, you know, 4 days before Kennedy is killed, of course, there was a special presidential briefing which notes that Israel was sourcing weapons from France that were capable of carrying nuclear warheads, and it concluded with high confidence that Israel already had nuclear weapon capability, which is like quite extraordinary. And it's like, I mean, you know, that if you follow the official file trail, allegedly it's not until 1967 that the State Department and the CIA learn of this, but it's quite clear that they knew very well in advance. And indeed, Kennedy, as you mentioned, he made inspections at Dimona kind of a core component of normalizing relations with Israel. This was kind of bitterly opposed, but they finally relented and then camouflaged areas of the complex to conceal the fact that they were developing nukes. But Kennedy was never convinced that they weren't, and I think that he wrote to Ben Gurion a few months before he died, warning him about nuclear proliferation. Like Michael Collins Piper, who is, you know, a racist and actual anti-Semite, wrote a book called Final Judgment, which you know, I kind of dismissed at the time because of his politics. It seems to gain greater currency and credibility over time. Quite bizarrely. But you mentioned disjunctures between the Kennedy administration and LBJ's. Vietnam's obviously a big one, but also the approach of Johnson towards the global South, the non-aligned movement, places in countries in Africa, which had nationalist leaders that JFK was supportive of. That all ends when Kennedy is out of the picture, and I wondered whether you were able to perhaps explore like how other, not just Israel, but you know, other like countries such as say France or Britain benefited from this shift.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So if you would look at the three most resource-rich places in the global South and the third world, they all were, there was a reversal from the Kennedy years by Johnson in Johnson's administration that was dramatic and had terrible consequences for each place. So Brazil, okay, biggest, most resource-rich country in South America. Congo, most resource-rich country in Africa, a very resource-rich place in general. And then Indonesia, which had wealth beyond imagining. It actually had the biggest gold mine in human history, and the president of Indonesia didn't even know it. And JFK didn't know this, but Alan Dulles knew this, who was the fired director of the CIA, who was a lawyer for Sullivan and Cromwell and then worked for Standard Oil and was a part of this team that discovered this. So when they overthrow it, when they put Suharto in charge in Indonesia, you know, British intelligence is involved in that, the Dutch intelligence, some Japanese intelligence, like the people like in the Yoshio Kodama anti-communist league milieu are involved in Indonesia. In Brazil, you have the Chilean intelligence is involved in that. No, it's the other way around. It's when they had the Chilean coup, they used the Brazilians in there. But I'm sure in Brazil, they use whatever allies they have in the area to affect that coup in 1964. And in Congo, of course, the Belgians and the British are there, along with, you'd expect, the French to have been involved as well. They were. It's a transition to neocolonialism. So after the World War II, you have the U.S. policy is one of decolonization. And some people actually favored something like actual independence. People like Henry Wallace, who was Roosevelt's vice president, and JFK. JFK actually helped Sukarno in Indonesia move to nationalize some Western companies because they needed some ways to generate foreign exchange to be able to have their economy be functional at all. But this gets reversed. And after this, you have, you know, decades of tragedy in Indonesia, Congo. In Indonesia and Congo, you have millions of people that die because of this reverse. And in Brazil, you have a dictatorship and messed up politics that continue up to the present day. Not that there weren't antecedents to that in Brazil, but it was a reversion to form in Brazil that was pretty brutal, and it was military dictatorship. So a lot swung on Kennedy's assassination and those reversals in foreign policy, for sure. And the part of the way that they make the deal with the Western Europe, because Western Europe used to have its own little empires all over the place, like Belgian Congo and Dutch Indonesia and so on, that they help these people, these companies, these enterprises that are in those countries still be able to operate and make money. So there's a lot, the West becomes, it becomes this dollarized world, and the U.S. is ultimately the judge of what's the policy is going to be in the third world and elsewhere, and they control the money, but they bestow patronage to other people. They allow them, they protect their invested capital in other countries. So it's like this Western oligarchic project where the U.S. is the, you know, essentially the CEO of Western imperial capitalism.
Indeed. And I think that one of the interesting, again, this is a kind of disjuncture, and it's what makes, I think, the American empire, A, kind of different from the empires that preceded it, but B, as well, might kind of contribute to why people find it difficult to pin down, is that it's this kind of, as far as I can tell, and this is what comes through in your writing, is the American empire is this kind of amorphous blob of, like, you know, economic interests are, like, very prominent within the power structure, whether that's, you know, in the form of organized crime, or, you know, like the CIA being effectively a bunch of Wall Street bankers and, you know, lawyers who sought to line their own pockets and create, you know, greater business opportunities for themselves. That's not really the case with, say, like the British Empire. I mean, of course, that was centered around, you know, economic expansion and exploitation, but it's not that kind of mafia element isn't really there. Maybe a piratical element is, at least in the at the very start. Why do you think that the American Empire is so well, for want of a better word, exceptional in imperial terms?
That aspect of it is exceptional and different. I have to confess to not being an especially adept student or an erudite student of the British oligarchy and what they were doing all those years. I mean, something about the way that the state functioned and the way that those businesses functioned, if you're saying they didn't have a national crime syndicate, which is true, but they had the East India Company, which was a giant narcotics trafficking organization, you know, with the British flag. And if you have that, what do you need a syndicate for? You got it right there, and it's actually just waving the flag. I mean, that's a part of it. They are closest to the British Empire in terms of their financialized model of weighing countries down with debt and using indirect rule. and any sort of dirty trick to maintain your control and divide and rule, all these sorts of tactics. So they're the closest to the British Empire, but they are something different. And I think that it has to do with the fact that the U.S. is so purely capitalistic, but also with this democratic facade. And so it really, there is no transcendent American value over time and space, except for one, and that is money. Money is, the U.S. was founded as a commercial enterprise. The colonies were established by the Massachusetts Bay Company, and before that, the Virginia Company. And these were people looking to set up colonies in order to make money. And the first crop is tobacco. So they weren't settlers thinking like, is there going to be enough land for me to grow crops and raise a family? It was, can we come here and maybe if we could steal things like the Spanish did, if we find them, but if not, we can set up some kind of commercial enterprise. And the thing that they find is tobacco, which is not, it's not that they're growing and smoking it, they're shipping it to England. Okay, and this is lucrative, and this attracts more people to the U.S. The pilgrims themselves were trying to get to Virginia when they left, you know. And the reason that the pilgrims need to leave Britain and Holland in the first place is because of the enclosure movement, which was capitalism. So capitalism makes the British go and exploit and brutally dominate Ireland. But, you know, Ireland, which they do, and that leads to the potato famine and everything else. But that's not really going to be enough. They go further west and they colonize North America. It's capitalism in England. That's the birth of capitalism and the birth of the bourgeois state, essentially. And it cannot but be imperialistic. So they go to Ireland, and even that's not enough. You know, you've taken all the land from people. You need something with that extra population, and you have more, you have some capital to invest because you've accumulated capital. So you brutalize Ireland, and then you go further west and you go to North America. And they were worse than the Spanish, even though the Spanish are the, you know, the black legend of what they did, which was pretty horrific. But if you look at North America, you know, in like 1950, it is very, very white. It looks very European. If you look at Latin America, there's a lot more shades of brown throughout Latin America, except maybe Argentina, where they committed genocide against everybody. They're pretty white. But so what I'm saying is that the capitalist imperialism with you know, missionaries and other things involved as well, but this is more brutal than this, what the Spanish did. It affects the genocide, and it's fueled by slavery. And Western expansion is just an endless imperial enterprise. It's capitalist imperialism. You're going further west. You're looking, first you want land to go west for slave plantations, or in the north, you want there to be like places for farmers. You know, you have more industry in the north, but then the slave economy in the south. And they go see the shining sea, right? And that could have been the end of this imperialist era, because they'd gone from sea to shining sea. They had enough land. But the problem is that with capitalism, you really cannot just set up a zone like this and then allow it to be governed. They needed to be constantly expanding and finding different outlets for capital, because if you don't have that, the population will want more. They'll want to have a more managed economy and have higher consumption, improvement in living standards. Just you would organize society differently if you couldn't go out and imperialize them, which is why as soon as they go see the shining sea, they essentially keep going west and they fight the Spanish-American War. They take over Hawaii, they fight the Spanish-American War, they make Cuba a de facto colony, Puerto Rico, they take that in the Spanish-American War. They get involved in the Boxer Rebellion, in the Boxer Uprising in China, which is just a sort of a beat down of the West on China at the time. It's so brutal and disgusting if you look at what they did. So the imperial capitalism is all the U.S. really is. It always was. There's older traditions and such in Europe, some pomp and circumstance and an idea of a noblesse oblige. And other aspects,
divine rights of kings, you know. Yeah.
There's other sort of cultural antecedents in Britain, or in Europe, but the U.S. is nothing but capitalism, and it's the most. It's supposedly Christian, but the fact that money, which is a man-made thing, becomes the god, it is the most idolatrous society, posing as a Christian society. but totally antithetical to, you know, the teachings of Jesus. I'm not saying you have to follow the teachings of Jesus, but Jesus, you know, and the Bible, they are against idolatry, and Jesus supported poor people over wealthy and powerful people. But it doesn't matter anything, because the power of money can bend anything to its will. In a society where money is the end-all be-all. And that is the most fundamental part of why things in the West have degraded the way that they have, because you could never put the brakes on imperial capitalism and the culture and political economy that it has to have.
Well,
once they become the hegemon of global capitalism after World War II, they are in charge of administering all the third world and everything else. So it just becomes, everything tends toward monopoly in imperial capitalism. And that's essentially what they did in terms of their role as the state managers of this imperial capitalist project. And then when the Soviet Union falls, there's the unipolar moment. And at that point, they're at their most insane. And as a result, we've been living through what we've been living through in the 21st century, which is unjustifiable, illegal wars based on ridiculous lies and fabrications.
Well, just to close out the era, our era, and just to draw from the point about the end of the unipolar moment, the fact that that moment has passed now, well and truly, and the American ruling class can see that there are powers in the world who they can't dictate to anymore. But they apparently, or certain factions in the United States, can't get over this. And so you have a lot of sort of thundering and shouting and threats of all kinds of things. But it seems like the structure that governed what you've talked about here, the American state and its subsidiary entities after World War II, seems the wheels are coming off now. You have like more revelations about Epstein. You have like various, should we say, psychological operations attempted that come apart almost as soon as they the wheels are put in motion. So is it your view then that things are falling apart and the center cannot hold, to quote W.B. Yeats?
Yes, and this is both encouraging and terrifying, because no empire has ever willingly given up its empire. People try to say that the British did, but that really wasn't true. The U.S. essentially checkmated them, and financially and militarily, what were they going to do, fight the United States? So the British were forced into that position, and it didn't mean the end of the empire. It just meant the management of the empire went to somewhere else, and they got relegated to a lower role. So nothing, what we're seeing now requires something unprecedented in human history, which is for an empire to just realize that it's defeated and not go down trying to fight with everything it has at its disposal. And the reason that the U.S. cannot fight with everything that's at its disposal is because this will destroy the world. And so we are in this bizarre moment where we're actually getting outproduced militarily. We're not the finest military in the world anymore. We're so riddled with corruption and greed with all of our procurement process and everything. Russia is not a communist country. But they own their own military contractors. Mm. It's owned by the state. There's no Boeing and Lockheed. There's no military industrial complex that way. So this makes them different than the West and makes them more efficient. And the West just, you couldn't even field an army in the West the way they have. I don't think you could find enough younger people to want to serve in a military force in the way that we mobilized for Korea or Vietnam. I mean, it's even as desperate as you make people, a lot of the people that they end up signing now are people who would have been rejected for, you know, mental or physical defects in the past. So the U.S. is it's a dying empire. Nobody believes in its institutions. The rest of the world thinks we're just the arch villains of the world, by and large. And so their soft power is in the gutter. They have very little left. And their hard power is being exposed as insufficient. I mean, they only... the only battles they seem to be winning are the ones where they're just murdering Palestinian civilians. They're losing in Ukraine in a slow but spectacular way, and I think in an inevitable way. And Israel was essentially begging for the conflict with Iran to end. And so we're all at this position wondering, what is the U.S. going to do? The sensible thing would be to begin to step back, not to attack Venezuela, not to attack Russia, not to attack China, not to attack Iran, but to realize that, like, that this project to take over the world and run it forever was a bad idea, and they shouldn't have done it.
And it's over.
And they've lost.
Mm. Indeed. Indeed. Well, no, Aaron, thank you so much for that remarkably insightful and illuminating talk. I heard a lot of things that were completely unfamiliar to me, and I'm sure our viewers and listeners will be suitably educated in things they didn't previously know as well. Where can people find you? How can people support your work? Social media handles.
You can find me on American Exception on Twitter or X, but the best way to support the work and to really listen to many hours of material that we put on this subject and related subjects, American Exception at Patreon, the American Exception podcast at Patreon. So I think it's patreon.com/American Exception. And I have many, many interviews with Peter Dale Scott and this Gray Alliance series with Max Arvo, who's really a fantastic researcher and a great guy. We're working on that now. I'm going to put more episodes out on it, but I'm also working on the Japanese translation of my book, American Exception, Empire in the Deep State, is coming to Japan. I've got to write a new preface for that. There's also an American Exception documentary that is basically finished. It's three parts, and we're looking for a distributor for that. So Kit and Alex, I'll send you guys the trailer for that if I haven't already. Have I sent that to you yet or no?
Oh, no, you haven't.
Okay. I'll send that to you. But really, yeah, if people want to follow me at American Exception on Patreon, that's a huge help. And maybe at some point we can carry that. We'll come back and talk about Watergate, because that's also another key chapter. And then also what happens with Reagan and Bush, which is key. The weirdest thing that's happened to me in the last few years is finding out that H.W. Bush really tried to stop this, and that he sent his Secretary of State to AIPAC in May of 1989, James Baker, and James Baker said, it's time to put aside the unrealistic idea of a greater Israel. And then they withheld loan guarantees to force them to negotiate with the Palestinians. And of course, Bush loses in 1992. So what I mean to say is, I've just scratched the surface talking about some of these things. And it is wilder than I would have thought, 5 years ago. I stand by all the theoretical things I put in my book and dissertation. But the Zionist angle is actually crazier and more important than I would have guessed at the time. And it's a bit mind-blowing.
Indeed. Well, no, again, thank you so much, Aaron. God bless you, and take care.
Thank you, guys.